Another thing we look for is what's the age of the property. Is we prefer newer on the student side because students are able to generally live in a nicer spot because they're usually getting some type of financial aid, whether that's from the institution, a grant, their parents, money that was saved for them to go to school.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to another Multifamily Monday episode. I'm your host, Sean Winslow, and this is the Multifamily Money Podcast. What's going on, everyone? Hope you all had a great weekend, having a great start to your summer. I was just at a multifamily conference, learned a lot of great stuff. So there's kind of the topic of the show. One topic really that I want to touch on, but before I get into that, I just want to share a little data that I picked up from the conference. An individual on a stage, you might know his name is Brian Burke, multifamily investor for decades, has owned thousands and thousands of units worth over $1 billion. And he kind of just gave a quick kind of economic outlook of where the market is, where he sees, the top markets to be looking at and what markets not to look at. And I just wanted to quickly just go over, because I thought this was interesting. The rent growth for the next 5 years, so 2022 through 2026, there's actually two top 10s I want to share with you, because the first one is pretty much all Florida. So if you want to invest in a top 10 rent growth over the next 5 year market, then go to Florida. But as we all know, everyone's going to be heading there, especially institutional money. So it's going to get even harder and harder to lock up a deal that makes sense, right? And as I always say, stick to those guns, stick to your metrics, your criteria, and buy based on that. Don't buy based on emotion or some top 10 list. But anyways, here we go. The top 10 metros for rent growth from 2020 to 2026. And obviously, this is all a projection, and it's from Axiometrics is the source of this data, if you want to go look it up. So number one is Naples and Marco Island, Florida. Two, Northport in Sarasota and Bradenton, Florida. Three, Cape Coral, Fort Myers, Florida. Four, Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater, Florida. Five, West Palm Beach and Boca, Florida. Number six, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And here we go, first non-Florida. Number seven, Phoenix, Mesa, and Scottsdale MSAs in Arizona. And then Tucson, Arizona, another non-Florida, and now back to Florida. Number nine, Orlando, Sanford, Florida. And 10, Jacksonville, Florida. But now I want to share you the non-Florida top 10 list for rent growth between 2022 and 2026. Number one, Phoenix, Scottsdale. Two, Tucson, Arizona. Three, Las Vegas. Four, Austin, Texas. Five, Myrtle Beach. Six, Salt Lake City, Utah. Seven, Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina. Eight, Nashville, Tennessee. Nine, Macon and Warner Robins, Georgia. You have a property there. 10, Bakersfield, California. As we learned in the presentation, and as I would never invest in Florida due to they're non-business friendly and non-landlord friendly, amongst other things that I would not invest there. So the next one, if you were to take that one out, would be Atlanta, Georgia. And the top rent growth was 10.8 in Phoenix, and number 10 was 8% rent growth over that period. And if we go look at the Florida ones, the top one in Naples was 15.5%, and Jacksonville, number 10, was 9.4. So still, with everything going on, that's still solid rent growth over the next 5 years. Obviously, not what we've seen in the past 2 years, but that's, as we all know, that's unprecedented rent growth, and we're not going to continue to see that. Maybe in the next few months, maybe the next 6 months or so, but beyond that, I do not see rent growth keeping up that pace. So that is solid rent growth over the next 5 years. And those are definitely markets you should consider. Three of them in there are target markets, which is great to see that they're still projected to be strong. But as always, these are just projections. So take that with a grain of salt. The overall sentiment of the conference was pretty positive. Obviously, going to be some bias angle to that because it's a multifamily conference, right? They're not going to come in and say the world is falling. But as always, anytime that we come through turbulent times, there's always opportunity. And so there's talk about, how cash is trash. Yes, especially when there's inflation, but it's also good to have some dry powder on the side. So when an opportunity does present itself, you can jump on that. And that's kind of what I've been talking about on this channel over the last few months. And as you know, I agree with that. So as always, stick to your criteria, stick to your guns when it comes to looking at deals. Don't act emotionally. And yes, cash is definitely trash, but you should be having some dry powder right now, especially with expenses rising, but also just so you can scoop up any opportunity that may present itself. But the main topic I want to talk about today is student housing. You know, I've talked about this topic before, and you can check that out on episode 58. I dive into why I like student housing. But the topic on student housing I want to talk to today is I got a bunch of questions. Because, you know, when you're at any conference, you meet people, they're always asking what you do. The big question everyone asks is like, what do you own, right? And I always feel awkward answering that question. Everyone wants to say, how many doors, how many units you got, right? And to me, that's not necessarily the end all be all, right? You could have, said this before, you could have 1,000 doors, 3% of each. It's still awesome, right? But it's not the same as someone who owns maybe 200 to 500 units who owns 30% or more of each. That's a big difference, right? To me, it's like, what's your net monthly income? That's, to me, that's what I'm striving for. Not necessarily the door count. I'd rather have fewer doors with a lot more monthly income than tons of doors, very, very little ownership, right? Now I get the scale, right? Because I want to scale too, because then that's when you're really building net worth, right? So don't get me wrong, I'm not saying I'm trying to stay small, but that's why I always think it's just a weird question, right? So one of the other questions I got, because they would ask me that, and I would obviously say how many doors I have, and then I would also break down, I have this many student housing beds. Most people aren't familiar with student, at least at these multifamily conferences. Well, they're familiar with them, but they've never done it before. So they always have questions. So we'd always dive into it. And like one of the biggest ones is just like, no, I've always been interested and looked at that. I just don't have, not really sure how to go about it. Like, what do you look for? That was the biggest question. So I wanted to jump into like, what is due diligence and underwriting on student housing look like? Now, I'm not going to go deep into the underwriting part. I'm just going to really go over the high level stuff. If you get sent a deal, should you even look at this deal? Right? Before you really underwrite it, like go deep in, what should you be doing? So let's say something comes across your email, student housing at a university. First thing to do is look up what is that university, right? So the first due diligence you do is on the institution itself, the college, the university, whatever it be. That's where you do your first kind of preliminary dive into this. And you want to, preferably I like 10,000 enrollment or larger. Now there are cases where I will go smaller, but I tend to like 10,000 above. I feel it's a more diverse crowd of individuals. And to me, more staying power, bigger institution, right? There's a reason why it's that size. Generally, that's probably going to lead to more, possibly more funding, bigger endowment, and so forth. Obviously, not always. So that's why you got to dig. And then really the biggest thing is look at the trend of enrollment. Has it been increasing? Has it been declining? Is it flatline? Is it no longer at the peak? For instance, we were recently looking at a deal, D1 school, 18,000 students enrolled. And in 2021, it just hit its peak enrollment ever. And it's been trending up, increasing year over year. That's a solid institution from that standpoint to look at, right? Just peaked even after everything that has recently happened. People are still going, want to go to that school. It's increasing and just hit its highest enrollment number ever. That's solid, right? And so if you saw something like that at first, and that's something you'd want to dig deeper into that institution, we prefer D1, doesn't have to be. But again, it's usually an institution that gets more funding, more eyes on it. It's good sports. We all know sports drive an institution that brings in a lot of its revenue dollars, especially if it's a good D1 school. I like to see that there is diversity in the degrees that are offered. Now, that's not necessarily an end-all be-all. Usually I don't like to go to a school where it's solely focused on, you know, one discipline, where what if something happens in that industry and there's really no need for that degree anymore, or at least how that degree is being offered. That's a bigger risk, right? So I like it better diversified. And then is the institution investing back into itself? One student housing we recently acquired, D1 University with just over 10,000 enrollment, and the school is investing $100 million back, has a plan to invest $100 million over the next couple of years back into the institution, from buildings, programs, and back into the university itself. So that's something you love to see, because the institution wants to grow. You know, obviously, believe in itself. The donors that are putting up that money obviously believe in the institution. So that's always great. And obviously, you'd like to see a healthy endowment. Schools build up endowments, so they have reserves, and then they can, one, invest back into themselves, but also just have that reserve there in case if anything was to happen. That's important. And then another big thing, obviously, this is really crucial, is what does their student housing look like? Are they primarily on campus? If so, that could be a tough situation. It doesn't mean it's a no-go, but it's definitely something I tend to kind of shy away from. But there could be opportunities where, yeah, it's primarily on campus, but this student housing building has been here for a few years, and it's really one of the only ones, and the students love it, then there could be a story for that. But I prefer to shy away from that. I like to see more towards off campus. You know, especially you'll see freshmen are usually on campus. Some institutions, you know, require freshmen to live on campus as a freshman the first year, and then they can move off. I don't really like to see it above, like, what's the ratio you want to look for? I don't really like to see it above 30%. Now, will I look at one that is above that, right? And by 30%, I mean 30% of students living on campus. I don't really like to see it above that. Now, I will look at it, right? As long as you're not going above 50%, I think you're pretty solid. So that's important to look at. And then you want to look at, like, even if you hit that ratio and it's really solid, most students do live off campus, like, where are they living? How many off-campus offerings are there, right? How many off-campus student housing developments are there? What's in the pipeline? Do they have a lot coming to market? What's the occupancy average in the market? You can find that on CoStar. Sometimes you can ask a broker, probably not the broker. If you're buying this from a broker, probably don't ask that broker. Obviously, they want to make everything look like sunshine and rainbows, right? So I would ask, maybe if you have a relationship with another broker in the market, ask them. That's a good source. And obviously, like I said, CoStar is good as well to see what's that average occupancy for students in that. And if it's low, then maybe it's something you want to stay away from. Like, why is this sub 90% at all of these? Not that in student that's terrible, but you definitely still want to be, prefer to be above, you know, in the low 90s. For instance, we recently acquired, there is other student housing in the area, but the location. So that's another thing, like anything in real estate, location, right? Because another thing we look for is what's the age of the property. Is we prefer newer on the student side because students are able to generally live in a nicer spot because they're usually getting some type of financial aid, whether that's from the institution, a grant, their parents, money that was saved for them to go to school. They have a little more cushion to pay for these things than maybe they do when they graduate, right? So they tend to want the newer thing because it has, obviously it's newer, it's nicer, but it also has a lot of amenities. Amenities are big for students. So my point was, I was saying, is one of the ones we recently bought, it's not the newest, it's not old, it's an 07 build, but not the newest. But the location is just, you can't beat the location. It's the closest off-campus housing to the campus. It's 0.2 miles away, walkable. There's a bus stop at the end of the entrance that comes at a regular schedule to pick them up and bring them if they don't want to walk. And then you got to look around. Okay, so it's the closest one now, but could someone develop and be closer? And in this circumstance, no. They literally can't get closer because it's surrounded by buildings that the college owns and also just unbuildable area of roads and what have you. So currently, it's the closest and there's no room for development for anything to be closer. So that is very important. And you also want to look, like I mentioned, the amenities. Are there amenities? What are the amenities? And if they don't, is there a play for you to add them? So obviously, that's a value-add strategy if you're able to. Is there space to, maybe if they don't have a pool, add a pool? Luxury grilling station. They have pool tables, ping pong, study lounge. The new thing is like a lot of keyless entry storage for Amazon packages. We all know everyone online orders now. That's a huge thing. And it's not that the student housing complex has to have it now, but are you able to add those? And that's because amenities are really huge, especially in student. They want all the top of line stuff. So that's important. And when it comes to branding, are they doing a good job at branding? Do they have relationships built with the school, with the sports teams? Do they go to the different convention the schools host? Do they post at the school on the school social media? Do they have a social media presence? And this is not all necessary. This could be another value add to implement. Are they not doing that? Well, we can do that and get better. And if you're going to third party manage, which I highly recommend on student, especially if you've never done it before, is does your third party management, property management company, one, they better have done student. One we use, they're actually really known for student housing. It's a different way to manage, right? Because you have kids. And one thing that our property management does on every single student property we own is they create a social media presence for the property itself. Gen Z, they're all on social media, TikToks, Instagram, Snapchat, all of that. And so we create that social media presence and we do reach out that way as well. In that sense, it is a lot different than multifamily from the operations standpoint. Those are all things you really want to look at before you really deep dive into the numbers of the property itself. And then when you go to underwrite, it's relatively the same. Obviously, pre-leasing is a big thing, a big difference in student versus multifamily. Whereas in multifamily, you're getting, there is a leasing season, usually spring into summer is the strongest one, but it's not like that's the only time to lease up, right? You're leasing up throughout the year. Every month, you're having leases end and you're bringing in someone new. But that's not the same in student. In student, it's based on the curriculum, right? So students are going to come in and go to school August, September, and they're going to leave that 12 months later. We do full 12-month leases. We don't do it based on the curriculum. We start based on like right before the curriculum starts, but we go full 12 months. This isn't like a 8-9 month lease. This is full 12 months. So they either have to pay through the summer if they're not there or find a subletter that we have to approve. So that's important as well. So that's the main difference. And when you're buying, you really want to see, especially it all depends on the time of the year. Now, if you're buying end of summer into fall, they're most likely pre-leased, they're leased for that year. So you're fine. And you don't really have to worry too much about their pre-leasing for the next year, because that doesn't really start until the first of the year and then really kicks up in towards the spring. Now, if you're buying in that time frame, that's very important to monitor that. I've seen it with other operators where they've gone under contract in the spring, late spring, and goes into the summer. And as they're doing their due diligence and their escrow period, close, and then the occupants, the pre-lease doesn't hit the number that the bank wants. Maybe it's not even at 85, not at 90. It's because the current ownership has taken their foot off the gas because, hey, we're selling this. Or the management company's like, yeah, they're selling this, but we don't need to really worry about pre-leasing. We're not going to be on this property. So you got to be really careful with that in terms of acquisitions for a student. Obviously, in an ideal world, I'd only acquire it, start acquiring a student right after they leased up for that current year. So like in the fall, but that's obviously not always the situation. Student deals are being brought to market all the time, but that's definitely something you want to look out for. So that's pretty much the basics when it comes to doing due diligence, underwriting an institution. Now, you can go a lot deeper, right? That's kind of what I do at the onset of it. Like, do I even want to look at this deal? Because right now it could be an amazing deal, right? You could underwrite the deal and be like, this is a solid deal. Then you look at the institution, it's like enrollment has been declining. Like look at in the, I always Google the institution to see if anything's in the news. Oh, there's in the news, they're apparently having financial troubles. Like then that's something I would probably want to shy away from, right? Like, yeah, the deal looks good now, but what's it going to look like in 5 or more years? So that's why I always do the institution first. Obviously the state too. Still, we only look mostly in the Southeast, some in the Midwest, mostly in the Southeast and those business friendly states. Georgia's a great one, actually. Not a lot of people know this, but people who live in Georgia obviously do, but outside of this, I didn't know it a few years ago, but Georgia has a program. And don't quote me on this because I can't remember the name. But if you meet a certain merit in terms of grades and you stay in state, they pay for your tuition. So that's another great reason to own student housing in Georgia, because they're always full because it's a great way to go to school for essentially free, or at least the tuition part, right? And then they can also, then they have more money to spend on housing. But yeah, I just wanted to go over quickly and share with you how I underwrite the institution, the university, the college before I jump into a student housing deal. And again, if you want to jump into why I love student, episode 58, take a listen, but quick overview. I like it as a diversification play because I love housing. I love apartments, but I also want to diversify. And it goes back to when I was in college, 08 during the financial crisis. I studied finance, so I knew there was a recession. But outside of that, I didn't feel it other than like learning it from my teachers and researching it myself. I wouldn't have known. I wouldn't know there's a recession. It's just completely different when you're in school. So you got to think whatever method you're going to school, whether you work your butt off and saved up money yourself, if you've done that, much respect to you. That's amazing. Or maybe your parents worked really hard to be able to provide you a college education. Maybe you worked your butt off and got a scholarship, a grant, whatever happens. More often than not, the money's already there to get you through college. So even if times are recession, it's, to me, when I was in college, I didn't know anyone that had to leave because of what was going on in the financial markets because we're in a recession. More often, like I said, more often than not, that money has, it's already been planned that you're going to go there. So the money's already there to go. So to me, I like it from that aspect. Even during COVID, yeah, there was in some places there was a pullback. But if you look for 2020, for the most part, when it happened, tuition was already paid for. Now, maybe some schools did some type of reimbursement, but I heard the ones I know didn't, and they just went to virtual learning, but they still had the lease, right? And that goes again to doing due diligence on the school. So that circumstance, when we were doing due diligence, we wanted to make sure, okay, is this institution doing away from virtual learning, going back to in-person? So we'd only look at ones that said, yes, we're going back, you know, that year to in-person. At this point, it's really resilient. Now that could change in the future. At the time, it's just a really resilient space. And on top of that, more often than not, your student is getting co-signed by their parent for their lease. So you know they're going to be paid there for a reason. Those are just some of the few things I like about it. Again, if you want to get a deeper dive into why I like it, check out episode 58. Hope you guys got some value out of this. As always, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out. You can find me on Instagram. My handle is at Sean Owens, or on LinkedIn. Just type in Sean Winslow. You can always find us at Greenbrier Capital Group as well. That's greenbriercg.com. All right, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. Get out there and crush it. Only you can achieve your dreams. No one else is going to be there to do it for you. So get out there, meet people, provide value. Always come from a place of value. I guarantee more will come back in return. All right, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'll catch you on the next one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and, of course, share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.